Okay, any preliminary questions? Okay, we left off yesterday with on the verge of talking about Paul's graph, and I gave you kind of an overview of what Paul's graph is, what it's all about. And again, what I want you to come away with from this is not so much a perception that Cardozo is always for the defendant and Andrews is always for the plaintiff, that if you followed one or the other, it would tell you what the outcome is, but that they approach the same problem by asking different questions. And the best way really to flesh that out is just to lay the opinion or lay the case out and look at the opinions in light of the facts. So can somebody tell us about Paul's graph? Ms. Dudley. Okay, and let's pause here for a moment and just sort of review the bidding. Again, the defendant's agent, the defendant's employee, the railroad agent here, is responding to the passengers trying to get on the train at the last minute. And let's suppose, for purposes of our discussion, that there is some standard of care expected of the railroad's employees. Let's suppose there's even a rule book that says, okay, when a train is within 2 minutes of its scheduled departure time and passengers are trying to board the train with less than 2 minutes to go, you, the employee, are to direct them away from the train and tell them to catch the next train. That it's too dangerous to have people jumping on and off the train at the last minute. That's the way people get hurt. Don't do it. And let's suppose the defendant in this case violated that rule and thinking he was helping these people, but in violation of his own company's policy, he's pushing and shoving people on and off the train. Does Cardozo think that behavior could be characterized as negligent? Not in relation to the... I think what you meant was not in relation to the plaintiff. Yeah. Not in relation to Mrs. Paul's graph, in other words. Okay. So what Cardozo says in this opinion is that, well, first of all, if he were preparing a case book and he had to place this case in the chapters that we have covered, which chapter would it go in? Right, right. It's a chapter one question, according to Cardozo. And as you say, in his analysis, there may be negligence as to the people on the train, but there's no negligence as to Mrs. Paul's graph. And say again why it is that the same act of pushing these people on the train, which might be negligent as to, for example, a passenger on the train who gets injured when the flying passenger who's being thrown onto the train lands on someone else on the train and hurts them. That same negligent act, which, oh, by the way, allows some fireworks to fall and explode and eventually injures Mrs. Palsgraf, why isn't that negligent vis-a-vis Mrs. Palsgraf? Just say it again. You've already said one. Okay, and why does foreseeability matter? But why does that fact matter legally? Well, except foreseeability is relevant to Cardozo's determination of what aspect of negligence. If the thing is not foreseeable, then what follows from that logically, according to Cardozo? No foreseeability means no. Yes, but why? It means no negligence, but why is a lack of foreseeability fatal to a finding of negligence, according to Cardozo? There's no duty. Cardozo's idea is that the duty to use reasonable care flows out of a perception of risk. As he says, if I'm walking down the street and I see a pile of newspapers, if I have no reason to believe that those newspapers pose any kind of risk to me or anybody else, then walking over them unceremoniously without, you know, I don't have to walk around them, I don't have to, you know, sort of poke them gingerly with my feet before I step on them, I can pay no attention to them because I have no reason to think that's a danger to anybody. A reasonable person only exercises additional care, and therefore the law expects of the reasonable person to exercise care only when they have reason to believe that there's a risk involved. Otherwise, you're free to treat the situation like a bunch of newspapers on the ground. By contrast, of course, if we were told that somewhere in this city a terrorist has planted a bomb hidden in newspaper, then, as we saw a pile of newspapers on the street, instead of just walking over them and not worrying, then the reasonable person, before they casually walked over them, would say, gee, I wonder if this is the bomb we've heard about. The difference, again, is that the law says, according to Cardozo, that the expectation to use reasonable care arises from the ability of the reasonable person to foresee potential danger. They're not trying to harm anybody on the train. They're trying to help, albeit in a way that turns out not to be reasonable. People make mistakes in the way they try to help somebody. But what Cardozo is trying to distinguish is the expectation we have with respect to the people on the train. With respect to them, Cardozo says, we can expect the guard to use reasonable care. But we can't expect the guard to use reasonable care with respect to someone, Mrs. Palsgraf, who's so far away that no reasonable person would expect her to be put at risk by anything the guard is about to do. But wait a second. On that point, there's no reason why we would view those as being exclusive. That is, sure, the person carrying the bomb, the guy carrying the fireworks onto the train, maybe as to him, we would say Mrs. Paul's graph is foreseeable, because if I have a bunch of explosives, even in the form of fireworks, but I know that I have these things, then arguably, exercising reasonable care would perceive a potential danger that explosives might, you know, one thing might fly off and these baggage scales over here fall down and hurt somebody. But the knowledge of the person holding this package is different from the knowledge of the railroad employee. Well, and again, what we're trying to identify here is the distinction between Cardozo's methodology, the question that he asks and then answers, as distinguished from the question that Andrews answers and then, that Andrews asks and then answers. Cardozo's question is, was the defendant negligent? And his answer is, as to Mrs. Paul's graph, no. Because he couldn't foresee any injury to Mrs. Paul's graph. Therefore, no duty. Therefore, no negligence. End of discussion. Andrews, on the other hand... Now, before we get to Andrews, there's one more thing we need to talk about with reference to Cardozo's view. Cardozo limits the scope of liability to what is within the orbit of duty. And what is the orbit of duty? Or there's a term that is used, I can't remember whether Cardozo uses this exact phrase, I think he does, but we can refer to it as the zone of danger. Cardozo again says that from the defendant's perspective, you can, and this is somewhat metaphorical, but it's actually close to being literally spatial, that there is this zone in which you owe people a duty. And if you don't exercise reasonable care, the people within that zone of danger can hold you accountable, but the people outside the zone of danger can expect nothing from you. If the eye of reasonable vigilance from the defendant's perspective could not foresee that Mrs. Paul's graph was in the zone of danger, she's out of luck. That's Cardozo's method of analysis. It's a Chapter 1 question. It's all about negligence and about the scope of duty. Ms. Rossi. Because he's Cardozo. Logically how he does it is
to say the guard owed a duty to the people on the train. The guard didn't owe a duty to Mrs. Paul's graph. And legally speaking, even as we distinguish Cardozo and Andrews in their methodology, we need to recognize a family similarity in that both of them agree to the concept of limiting legal liability. Both of them say legal liability should go so far, but no farther. They differ about where that line is to be drawn, but Andrews, again, is not... You shouldn't have the kind of dichotomy here in which Cardozo is this stingy curmudgeon who won't give you the time of day, Whereas Andrews is Santa Claus. You know, what do you want? Here it is. They just have different ways of defining how far they'll go and where they stop. So again, what Cardozo says is legal liability should be extended to those people as to whom the defendant could foresee the potential of injury. But if you're so far outside the zone of danger that a reasonable person could think, you know, no matter, even if I fail to use reasonable care here, it's not going to put that person at risk. If that's a correct statement, according to Cardozo, the law shouldn't make the defendant liable to that person, even at the same time why it says for the very same act, the defendant can properly be held liable to somebody else. I'll agree with you and disagree with you. I think what Cardozo says is the guard could not foresee that these guys had fireworks or explosives that would fall and cause an injury to Mrs. Paul's graph. That part, he does say, is unforeseeable, but it's not as though Cardozo is saying that their behavior in throwing these people on the train wasn't by itself something that was negligent, and had the person claiming injury been local rather than long distance, Cardozo is not denying that the behavior might be negligent for some other purpose. But what Cardozo explicitly refuses to do is to give the label negligence to, or negligent, the adjective negligent, he refuses to give that to something by itself, Mr. Negligence per se, from Martin versus Herzog. He will not say this act was, he refers to that almost, not contemptuously, but certainly critically. He's saying, I don't think there's negligence in the air. Not negligence sort of, you know, without this disembodied kind of negligence. It's got to be, it's relational. Negligence as to whom, he wants to know. And unless you answer him on that point and show him that the relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff was such that a duty of care arose, he's saying, I don't see how you can get negligence unless the relationship gives rise to a duty of care. Sure. If the negligent act is you put baggage scales in a place where the least little thing and they fall down and hurt people, then as to that, you look at the behavior of the employee, screwing the eye hook into the ceiling, and you say, could the eye of reasonable vigilance attaching the baggage scale foresee that it might fall on somebody? Well, yeah, that's the eye of reasonable vigilance. The zone of danger for that person would include Mrs. Paul's graph. Well, except it would have been, the railroad would be the people that put the baggage scales in. Again, the plaintiff in this sense may have picked the wrong theory, that what the defendant did negligently was not push people on the train. What the defendant did negligently was attach the baggage scales to the ceiling or whatever it was that caused these baggage scales to fall down. Then Cardozo wouldn't have had any basis for limiting the scope of the defendant's duty. The concept, I think, for Cardozo, as we'll see later on in Kinsman Transit, as we begin to apply Cardozo's theory to Kinsman Transit, the concept is that you sort of freeze frame, you hit the pause button at the moment when the defendant's about to do the negligent act. about to push the people on the train, and you push the pause button, and you ask the question, okay, let's be that person for a moment, and let's look through the eye of reasonable vigilance. In that moment, would it be something that the eye of reasonable vigilance would anticipate, gee, if I screw this up, it could harm, again, we define a zone of, well, it could go this far, it could go that far, maybe somebody down at the end of the car here, I throw this guy on the train, he slides all the way down to the end, hurts, you know, there's a zone of danger here of people that might get hurt, but there is a limit to that. And from the time that I hit the pause button, I can't really, at least not reasonably, foresee that even if I screw this up, I just can't figure the way that it's going to hurt Mrs. Paul's graph. I can't get there from here. Cardoza says, if that's the situation, if the eye of reasonable vigilance couldn't perceive that, no duty. Okay, now let's switch over to Andrews to see, because again, Andrews asks a different question. As I think I said yesterday, this is often the key to winning a debate, or I think as I said, you know, if you're a politician, you get asked one question, you want to rephrase, well, I think the question you really want to ask is this one, and here's my answer to that question. Now, that can be an evasive dodge of a question you really ought to answer, but it may be a way in which you properly say you're asking the wrong question. You've certainly identified a problem, but the key to understanding the problem is to think about this issue. And if you think about this issue, that's the way in which you can begin to solve the problem. And there's no rule book that says, here is the priority of the questions. So people wind up, in effect, debating over what's the right question to ask as much as they debate whether so-and-so has a better answer to a given question. Okay, so Ms. Connor Dudley, you were tell us now about Andrews. How does Andrews say we should think about this problem? Okay, let's pause right there to say that Andrews says negligent acts, he essentially is okay with the idea of negligence in the air. He's saying a negligent act is, what was that? Somebody whose behavior is unreasonable. Yeah, an act which unreasonably threatens the safety of others, undefined others, that's a negligent act. If I start running out the door here, not looking where I'm going, that's a negligent act. I could bump into people, bad things could happen. I'm on the freeway, I'm trying to read the paper and make a cell phone call and talk to the people in the back seat and eat a sandwich all at the same time. That's a negligent act with reference to, I don't care, it's just that's a dumb thing to do. That's taking an unreasonable risk with regard to the safety of others. Now, says Andrews, we get to the important question. Even if you do something that is negligent, that unreasonably threatens the safety of others, you're only liable for those consequences which, what's his standard? Well, I just want you to repeat what you said before. Bingo. Negligence only leads to liability for those things which are proximately caused by the defendant's negligence. So you have a negligent act here, shoving people on the train. in violation of industry custom or your rule book or staff. It's a negligent act. But we're going to begin to identify the people who are able to recover not by some single zone of danger thing, but with respect to those consequences where we can say, oh, the defendant's negligent act proximately caused these damages, but didn't proximately cause those damages. Who makes that decision, according to Andrews? Who makes that decision? If the question before the House, according to Andrews, is which damages were proximately caused by the defendant's negligence, who answers that question according to Andrews? And we get these, again, these metaphors, chains and streams and pebbles dropped in a pond and so forth. But I just want the institutional body that makes the determination. Yeah. The jury makes that decision. Again, contrasted with Cardozo, who thinks that the question is one of legal duty. And it has historically been thought that while a jury decides whether some behavior was negligent, that is, whether the defendant breached a duty toward the plaintiff, is this or is this not negligence? The logically prior question of whether the defendant owed a duty to the plaintiff has been thought to be a question of law. That's about the nature of the law itself rather than applying the law to the facts. That is the question the judge has to decide. And again, Cardozo jealously guards that prerogative to say, these are the limits of legal liability. I, the judge, will tell you what they are. Hear, O Israel. This far the law goes and no further. Whereas Andrew seems to think, well, gee, this is not some highfalutin legal philosophy stuff. This is a matter of common sense. Who's got common sense? Jurors. Let them figure it out. Don't be so hyper about this, Cardozo. Relax. Have a beer. You know? Mellow out. And again, this illustrates the kind of contrast between two different approaches to essentially what the job of the judge is. In Cardozo's eyes, the job of the judge is to keep this legal system from spinning out of control. And Andrews thinks that the job of the judge is to be more of a traffic cop, keep the jury from, you know, going completely berserk, but within their sphere of competence, which is making these practical judgments, let them do their thing. So, again, Andrews doesn't disagree that lines have to be drawn, but he doesn't think that we have to draw lines in such a sort of philosophical, logical way. He's saying the lines have to be drawn in a more sort of intuitive. Let your sense of fairness be your guide, Mr. Viviano. But Andrews thinks that Cardozo missed the call of the question.
Right, but if Cardozo's argument is not unaddressed,
then never existed. Well, Andrews could have done, I think, a more... He could have done a better job meeting Cardozo's argument head-on, but he does address it in passing in saying negligence, in effect, is behavior that poses an unreasonable risk to the safety of others.
Right. I feel like Cardozo's argument was like
But I think what Andrews doesn't accept as a first principle, again, Andrews in defining the terms of debate, is to say, why is it, or who says, Mr. Cardozo, that negligence is person-specific, that there isn't any negligence in the air? You don't even state that in positive terms. You say, we may be at least doubtful or something like that. Where does he say this? Where is he talking about negligence in the air? Yeah. But again, he sort of asserts this without giving us, I mean, he cites some authority for it, but it's not clear that's the law, I would say. I mean, he's actually citing a treatise here. And, of course, what else does he cite? Martin versus Herzog, his favorite author. I'm not here to make a brief for Andrews. I think that in many ways the two opinions pass like ships in the night, because again, they ask different questions and proceed to answer the question they want to answer. Now, for our purposes again, what we have to figure out is, well, does this make any difference? What do I care whether it's Cardozo who gets to define the terms of the debate or Andrews who gets to define the terms of the debate? Part of what mattered a whole lot more then than matters now is, just as in Martin versus Herzog, in Cardozo's day, assigning a question to the judge was much more likely to produce a defendant-friendly answer than assigning that same question to the jury. Today, I think the sociology is such that the class of judges is not inherently more, you know, kind of establishment conservative type than jurors. You're as likely to find jurors who listen to Rush Limbaugh, the old Rush Limbaugh, are defendant friendly, and as you are to have a judge who's grown up on with the Trial Lawyers Association. Nonetheless, I think the idea of having the decision be one that is more kind of pragmatic, that's part of Andrews not only wants to assign this question to the jury rather than to the judge, but Andrews wants over and over again says, don't talk to me about logic, don't talk to me about doctrine, don't talk to me about philosophy. Tell me about practicality. What makes sense to you? What floats your boat, in effect? And if it works for you, I can live with that. Because we don't all have to be consistent here. We're just bumbling our way through this, deciding cases as best we can. And it'll all come out in the wash. Again, relax. Now, again, Andrews says there are, despite the fact that this is a flexible decision based upon practical politics and common sense rather than doctrine, he says there are still some things that can guide us in coming up with the right answer to the question about proximate cause. So let's see, where are we here in Andrews' opinion? I guess it's on page 64, right-hand column in the middle. There are some hints, he says, that may help us. I would prefer that he says a proximate cause. He quickly goes on to say, involved as it may be with many other causes. So again, I think it's more helpful if we keep referring to a proximate cause, one of many, rather than the proximate cause suggesting there's only one. But a proximate cause must be at the least something without which the event would not happen. What's that? That's our old friend, the but-for-cause test. So he's saying proximate cause includes but-for-causation, but in addition, to find something a proximate cause, we want to know whether there was a natural and continuous sequence between cause and effect. That's the language that sounds like the first part of our pattern instruction. And he just continues. Was the one a substantial factor in producing the other? Again, that's the language, or substantial factor is a term we use as a substitute for a strict but-for cause test. Was there a direct connection without too many intervening causes? And this goes back to his sort of metaphor that you drop the pebble into the pond and you get these ripples that extend outward, and for a while you can identify the original cause, but at some point there's so many intervening causes that you sort of lose track of what the original effect was. Yeah. How so? Well, some of that's incorporated here because he says, is the effect of cause on result not too attenuated? Is the cause likely in the usual judgment of mankind to produce the result? That's sort of the increased risk idea here. Or by the exercise of prudent foresight, could the result be foreseen? Foreseeability is a factor. But now getting back to your question, he said, is the result too remote from the cause? And here we consider remoteness in time and space. So in that sense, proximate is a spatial and temporal quality. It can't be too far removed in time and space. At least that's one of the things which will eventually have us conclude, although the defendant's negligence caused the plaintiff's injury, it's not a proximate cause. And again, what Cardozo is doing here is he's not denying the relevance of any of Cardozo's thinking. He's just saying, don't make it an absolute. Don't be so inflexible here. Foreseeability is relevant. Sure, I want to talk about foreseeability as a factor. I invite the jury to consider the degree to which the defendant could foresee this. But just as a factor, I'll trust their judgment when they get to the end of this process. Give them all the stuff to think about. Chew on it a while. And then get back to me. Again, Andrews doesn't see the need for delineating with this sharp precision. Here's the zone of danger. These people are okay. These people are beyond the pale. Yeah. Not according to Cardozo, because according to Cardozo, legal liability depends upon the existence of a legal duty. And the existence of a legal duty is a question of law, he says. It's not the application of fact. Did this defendant do right or wrong by our standards? Was their behavior reasonable? Cardozo is saying the prior question, before we ever get to that one, is what is this plaintiff to this defendant? Did the law at any time impose on the defendant a duty to exercise reasonable care toward that plaintiff? In the absence of that legal duty, we never get this party started. Cardozo is not, I think for Cardozo the zone of danger is more metaphorical. What he's really saying is, could the eye of reasonable vigilance perceive a danger? And it may be that the distance in space or the distance in time is such that the eye of reasonable vigilance wouldn't have connected the plaintiff. Well, as I say in the notes, what I think is the more difficult question for a Cardozo aficionado is, what happens when the determination of foreseeability depends upon disputed facts? So that, according to the plaintiff, I told the defendant, watch out for such and so. And the defendant says, that conversation never took place. As far as I knew, blah, blah. Again, suppose the plaintiff introduces evidence that all the people in the train area were warned about people carrying fireworks, and the defendant vehemently denies that any such information was. According to the plaintiff, the injury would be foreseeable. According to the defendant, it would not be, and the determination of foreseeability depends upon whose story you believe. That, I think, has to go to the jury. But what Cardozo says is, to the extent that the determination of legal duty doesn't itself hinge upon disputed facts, but is an evaluation on these facts, does this class of defendants owe this class of plaintiffs a duty of care? Cardozo again thinks, I'm determining the scope of duty that the law imposes. That's a question of law. That's me. I can't give that to the jury. They tell us whether behavior is reasonable or not, but they don't define the scope of legal duty. Now, again, some of this is a tempest in a teapot over exactly which methodology you use. Your main goal is essentially, first of all, to identify on an exam, are we talking about a situation in which the defendant did something negligent vis-a-vis person A, but fortuitously plaintiff B, off someplace else, wound up getting injured from that conduct? If that's your scenario, we've got a Paul's graph problem, and we've got to address it in terms of saying the question is, even if D's conduct is negligent, even if it in fact caused B's injury in the sense that had D, the defendant, acted reasonably, this problem never would have happened, still, can we fairly blame the defendant for something to happen to somebody else? Let's say a fan in the stands in Wrigley Field, you know, suppose they reached over, you know, and interfered with the fielder's chance to catch the ball. And the Cubs tragically lose the championship series, riots in Chicago, 20 people die in the streets of Chicago. Yeah, maybe it's negligent to do this thing, but through this fortuitous set of circumstances, somebody else gets hurt. Can you trace this thing back? Maybe it's negligent. Maybe they get fined for it. Maybe they get, you know, barred from Wrigley Field for the rest of their natural life, which turns out to be quite short given the anger in Chicago. Again, the Paul's graph question says there are limits to legal liability. You're responsible for those consequences, again, according to Andrews, which are so in a relationship such and say this proximately caused this injury, but as you begin to stretch the chain of causation out, you reach a point where you say, yeah, it's a cause, but you know what? It's not a proximate cause. Or you have Cardozo in his mode saying, what's the orbit of danger? What's the zone of danger? How far could the eye of reasonable vigilance extend? as the fan is seeing the ball arcing up into the lights, thinking, well, what bad thing could happen if I reach out and try to catch this souvenir? Could the eye of reasonable vigilance see that riots will break out and 20 people will die? If not, Cardozo would say, not in the zone of danger. What's that? Well, in that case, I think both would conclude that the fan's not responsible for the riot deaths. But take Kinsman Transit, which is our next case, and I started to say we're going to pick that up on Monday, but we'll pick it up on Tuesday instead, on the Monday next week, which falls on Tuesday, right? When we pick this up again, we'll look at it in light of Kinsman Transit, where you ask the question, okay, here are these various defendants in the case. The person who's securing this boat negligently, not using reasonable care securing the boat. You have somebody who's negligently finishing his meal in the tavern. Maybe he's watching the end of the playoffs, wants to see the ninth inning before he goes back to his shift at the bridge. Which of the damages that occur from this strange Rube Goldberg type scenario, which of the people injured in that process can fairly claim that the people tying up the boats or the people raising the bridge are legally liable for that? And as one of the things that you see in Kinsman Transit is the difference between the majority and the concurring opinion in terms of the questions they think are relevant to ask. Is this a matter of pure legal doctrine? Judge Moore, dissenting or concurring and dissenting in Kinsman, is more of the more along the Cardozo line of thinking. Let's try to cut square corners here. The majority in Kinsman Transit says, City of Buffalo's got plenty of money. Why can't they pay? This isn't grand highfalutin legal doctrine. This is practical politics. Andrews told us it was. If that's your approach, they find it perfectly appropriate to say the City of Buffalo is a proximate, their negligence in failing to raise the bridge is a proximate cause of the subsequent injury. Whereas Judge Moore says, wow, I don't like that. I don't feel comfortable getting there from here. And he would, although he doesn't explicitly say I would follow Cardozo's route, the point is that Cardozo has a much more kind of strict doctrine to apply here. And even there, I wonder, when we get to Kinsman Transit on Tuesday, we'll be able to kind of see how applying each of these rules, maybe you come out at the same place, maybe you don't. Maybe you come out at a different place. Again, for purposes of the exam, my first major task is correctly identify, here's the Paul's graph issue. See it when it's there, don't see it when it isn't there, and then once you're there, say, hey, there are different tests that follow different. If you want to tell me about the difference between Cardozo and Andrews, if you think that's going to help your clients, so be it. The point is, I don't know how this is going to turn out, probably, if you've got that kind of scenario. But we'll pick that up on Tuesday.